From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Reporting from the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio, the last day. Later on today, we'll be hearing from the nominee, Donald Trump. But first, we spoke with Professor Anthony Montero, our regular political commentator, about events thus far. So, Professor Montero, it was an interesting evening at the RNC last night and all the developments in the media today so far, and it's early yet.
Definitely. Not just last night, but Donald Trump's interview in the New York Times this morning, where he repeats for the umpteenth time, it seems, and a lot of people don't want to believe him, that his approach to foreign policy is non-interventionist.
Right.
You know, when asked about, and was a provocative question, his position on Turkey's internal struggle or other countries' internal struggles, he says, and it's I'm almost quoting him, that how can we get involved in other people's internal struggles when we have to clean up our own mess?
That's right.
And he referred to it as our own mess.
Yep.
And on NATO, it's now, famous. And everybody's talking about it. He was asked, would he support the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, if they were, and this is hypothetical, attacked by Russia? And he says that, well, he would have to see if they had met their obligations to us.
Right.
I mean, this is huge. Yeah. This is a drawback from World War III.
Yeah.
Brinksmanship. Confrontation with Russia, a nuclear power. Now, just parenthetically, people should realize that a year ago, as the crisis in Ukraine heated up, the Russian government said that they reserve the right to use nuclear weapons to defend themselves.
Yep.
And I'm certain they have repeated this as NATO pushes closer with nuclear weapons and with over 50,000 troops, the bulk of which are Americans, as they push closer to the western borders of Russia. Russia is letting them know that they reserve the right to do whatever is necessary to defend their sovereignty.
Yep. And they're letting, by the way, not just the Americans know, but they're letting the Lithuanians and the Latvians and the Poles and the people who are allowing the stationing of these troops to say, oh, by the way, when we blow up those troops with nuclear weapons, unfortunately, mm-hmm. they're going to be on your territory.
Yeah. And that, so I think Trump represents a voice of reason as opposed to brinksmanship and recklessness and chaos that both party establishments and the foreign policy intelligentsia have gotten accustomed to.
Yeah. And they're framing it that way, too. The Atlantic has this article. Basically, it's now official. It's Hillary Clinton versus Vladimir Putin. And they're basically saying that Trump is a devotee of Putin, and wants to be an ally with Putin against the American people, and that Clinton and the neocons and neoliberals are the ones that are going to defend the American people from the evil Putin.
Yeah, that's right. And what Trump represents, and we said this yesterday, let's get to the rational kernel of all of this. Rather than the media inspired of Trump is the fascist, Trump is crazy, what Trump represents is what we used to call détente, peaceful coexistence, let's do business. Just to put it in a larger historical context, after the Russian Revolution, the Russian government came to the West and said, rather than, seeing us as an antagonist, let us do business. That is what Lenin's policy was. Unfortunately, the Russian people were taken into a great war. We call it World War II. You know, we don't need a repeat of that. And, you know, Trump, the anti-politician, is really challenging the political establishment, its rhetoric, its political correctness. This is huge, I think, Don.
Yeah, and also the approach not just to Russia and China, because he mm-hmm. says them together mm-hmm. most of the time, mm-hmm. But also the approach to intervention in these other countries, because mm-hmm. as you mentioned at the outset, he's talking about, well, what should we do about Turkey? And he's saying we have to clean our own house. Yeah. I mean, that is essentially the question that was posed over Iraq, Libya, yes. being posed now over Syria. Yes. You know, 35 countries in Africa where the intervention has taken the form of implementing U.S. military command and control over the militaries of those countries. Mm-hmm. And, by the way, some bases and troops and drone stations and all that. He's staking out an entirely different approach. Yeah. I mean, we could end up seeing, it appears to me, an actual pullback from the installation of American military bases around the world that has been nothing but rolled out since World War II, that were first installed, supposedly, to win World War II.
Yeah. Oh, no. What you're saying, I can't agree with more. I mean, it is a pullback from an expensive and unaffordable military empire. And, you know, we didn't mention AFRICOM yeah. and U.S. forces in 35 countries, you know, U.S. forces being resent to Iraq. Mm-hmm. We heard just the other day that the U.S. bombing in Syria killed a huge number of civilians, including citizens, under the guise of fighting ISIS. You know, Trump is the alternative to this aggressive, hegemonic, imperialist, military empire building project. There's no two ways about it. And, you know, again, we talk about the left. The left needs to stop the BS. You know, stop perpetrating. Either you're in the game and you're going to run with the big dogs, or get out of the way. This is not a time for directionless and self-absorbed and narcissistic protest, meaningless activity. This is a time to go among the masses. The issue at the largest level is war or peace. In some ways, it is more upon us and more urgent than even the issue of the climate, which is huge, but we even got a little more time with that. With this direction of foreign policy of the Obama administration, which would be increased and intensified and even put on steroids, under Clinton, with that foreign policy, war is on our doorsteps. We have to pull back. And that's what Donald Trump is saying.
Yeah, in terms of relating the two, war and climate change, as a matter of fact, if there's a nuclear exchange, there will be some profound impacts on climate and the environment in general.
Absolutely.
They're making much of the divisions, quote-unquote, in the Republican Party. We saw how this stuff plays out on television, but we also had a pretty good, you know, display of it up close last night. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, you and I had a brief conversation with
Michael Steele.
The former chairman of the Republican National Committee. You know, and a really generous guy, a really nice guy.
Yeah, he was, wasn't he?
Yeah, really, really. And you know, a guy that's trying to give some reason and rational explanation to what's going on within his party. Right. And if you recall, I asked him, did he see at this convention the presence of two parties, the Republican Party, the old Republican Party, and the Trump Party? And I asked whether or not this was in anticipation of the breakup of the old Republican Party. And he was, you know, quite certain that the Republican Party would survive. These divisions were deep, but not irreparable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that was before the Ted Cruz speech.
That's right. It was about an hour before.
Yeah, at least an hour before that. So we didn't have a chance to talk to him after that. Maybe we'll run into him today.
Yeah.
Hopefully we will. No, we have the anti-politician versus the politicians.
Right.
And you even saw it with Michael Pence,
right,
the nominee for vice president. I mean, he and Trump are saying diametrically opposite things.
Right.
You know, Trump and Newt Gingrich are saying diametrically opposite things.
Right.
You know, and the only commonality in foreign policy is that ISIS is the enemy.
Right.
Just like the only commonality in domestic politics for them is that Hillary Clinton is the common enemy.
Right.
But beyond that,
right,
there's very little agreement.
Right.
You know, and Trump, you know, is hovering around the convention. He's showing up. You know, he's putting his children on display. And they're doing a very good job of representing him. But he's performing not like a politician.
Right.
And he's upsetting everybody.
Yeah, they don't know what to do with it.
They don't know what to do with it. But you know something, Don? You know, as we drove from the motel that we're in into Cleveland, we're passing these huge steel plants, which are still there, but not working.
Right, like ghosts almost.
Like ghosts. Like ghost cities or ghost towns or ghost factories. And only a few miles from where we are is Lorain, Ohio. Steel plants closed down. Auto plants closed down. Nobody's working here.
Past that, Youngstown. And you want to turn around in the other direction and head towards Michigan. And,
right.
You know, all of that.
And this is the backdrop.
Yeah.
And Cleveland's downtown is okay, but it's not looking all that good.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's not a lot of going on. It's not a lot of people going to work or shopping. A
lot of vacancies, and that's with some of the storefronts, for example, have like Trump and RNC T-shirts and things. You know that they're rented for the month or
For the month,
and they paint. It's got fresh paint on the front, but next week they're going to be empty again, or maybe there'll be Trump T-shirts hanging there for the next 20 years until something happens. And Michael Moore, you told me this morning about that.
Yeah. I saw a clip of an interview or discussion between Michael Moore and
Bill Maher.
Bill Maher. And Michael Moore predicted that Trump will win the election based upon his winning and putting into play the industrial or deindustrializing Midwest.
Right.
I mean, this is, and he's from Flint, Michigan.
Right, which is his poster child for that.
And, that's right.
And his whole career as a filmmaker, the bulk of his career as a filmmaker, is right on that issue. I mean, this guy is the personification, certainly the chief propagandist for people who are affected by that.
That's right. In other words, you know, he looks at the world from his own existential position as a child of Flint, of Michigan, of the deindustrialized auto industry, all of that type of thing. And his sense, and I'm certain he's in touch with his people, his family, people he grew up with in Michigan, and what they're saying. Man, I, you know, our mouths are open all the time as we go around this place. And you know, it's so interesting, Don, and we talk about this as we, you know, as we went through the media center and and so on, how unready for this moment journalists in general are, but progressive journalism and progressive media are for understanding what's going on.
You know, and it was interesting, you know, when we saw the interview of Michael Steele, for example, one of the interviews last night, there is like this old paradigm that people are trying to apply to these new conditions, and there it seems reflexive, and it also seems, although in form critical, it lacks critical analysis, because when people are saying to Michael Steele that, you know, the Republican Party, they're basically laying blame on the Republican Party for the killing of young black men in the United States. Nobody thinks it. Oh, by the way, who's the president? Who's the attorney general? Right. Who are the people that a U.S. senator who's newly elected black U.S. senator keeps getting tossed by the cops over and over again? Who is the person that he should be calling to say, hey, why don't you get your attorney general out of her office and off her behind and out here and deal with this stuff? Because they're not just shooting thugs, quote unquote, or however people perceive of people that are getting shot in the street that are everyday people. They even do it to U.S. senators. They're off the ranch. It's not us.
Right.
And nobody's bringing that. Instead, that's somehow Trump's fault. Now, you know, I understand that the Republican Party took on the role of the white people's party. That, by the way, was the Democrats' role from before Civil War up until they started, up until today in some places. But there's no critical analysis of even the things coming out of their own mouths. Like, how would you pursue this to its logical conclusion, trying to find a solution?
This is so interesting, you know, and as we talked about it, as we observed it yesterday and generally, you know, here is the phenomenology of a certain part of the progressive media. White cops kill black people. There's no question about that. Yep. Do it regularly and are doing it more. You see what I'm saying? Then you look at the Republican Party. All white people. 2,800 or more delegates here. 18 of them are black. Little bit larger number, Latinos, Hispanics. You know what I'm saying?
Right, 22 or whatever.
Yeah, maybe 22. Yeah. It's embarrassing. Right. It's a white party. Right. But you know something? It's also a small town party. These are people who represent a party whose base is in rural America, in small town America, and in the suburban areas. These are people who are from white areas. It is a problem of the Republican Party, whether it is the party of police brutality and white supremacy or not. Is a big question for them. Of course, their politicians, their political leaders milk this for all it's worth.
Absolutely.
You know, this we're behind the police. We're behind. But, you know, when you get to the level of the ordinary people in this party, you begin to hear and see different things talking to these delegates. Now, but the phenomenology or the way of viewing the world that sees white people at the Republican Party and white cops and say, well, they're all the same.
Right.
It's the same thing. I think that's a mistake. Yep. You know what I'm saying? Right. We have to know accurately what these people are thinking. And this Trump thing, we have to rebuild America. We have to put the American economy on its feet again. The debt is getting out of hand. It's $19 trillion. In a year or two, it'll be $21 trillion. Well, what is the debt? Why do we have this tremendous debt? A big part of it, the major part of it, past wars, current wars, and future wars.
Right, that's right.
You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
An anti-war stance in the interest of rebuilding the country is not a white supremacist program.
Right.
Objectively, it is the opposite of that.
That's right. Objectively, it's anti-imperialist.
Yes.
Okay? Which means it's exactly the opposite of a white supremacist racist party, which rests on imperialism abroad and white supremacy at home.
And that logic is not lost to Trump. Again, you know, we talked about this before, and I encourage people, go to his Washington Post editorial interview. It's online. It's long. In part of it, the logic of rebuilding America, a part of Donald Trump's logic, is that we have to rebuild inner city black America. He says it. It is unacceptable that 50% up to 60% of black youth in Baltimore are unemployed. We have to change that. We have to set up economic zones to employ people. Well, but then he has certain other problems, contradictions. He's not for raising the minimum wage.
Right.
That's wrong.
Right.
But the fact that this, the whole question of rebuilding the America and withdrawing from American empire and imperialism is by putting that on the table, the framework, the paradigm of political discourse has changed.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And then that sets in motion a lot of things. I mean, one of the things that occurs to me is, for example, when he says, okay, Germany, France, UK, whatever, you have to spend your fair share, quote unquote, and the formula that they have now that they don't hold anyone to is 2% of GDP.
Mm-hmm.
But if you looked at, for example, the U.S. military ratio to GDP, it's probably 5 to 20 times that.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, if you were going to have an equitable distribution of this among allies who are equals, it would end up that way too. Well, the reason they don't even have the 2% in those countries is that the people would be in the streets 5 seconds after it was announced. And they're in the streets in France and Germany already and Italy and other places. And if they were to say, you know what, we need this because Russia, those people would suddenly say, really? Wait a minute, what's going on with Russia again? Because they need that money. They're living under conditions of austerity. They're rebelling against it. I mean, from Greece to Spain, to Portugal, to Italy, to Ireland, France, Germany, and a lot of the other smaller countries, too. The people are already suffering and angry and organizing against it. And if you were then to add this additional burden from the outside, from the United States, they would, who needs NATO? We agree with Trump. He's right. It's outdated.
Yeah.
And so these policy changes that appear to be either esoteric or subtle can actually be quite profound if you scenario them out. And that's, I think, one of the central ones.
Yeah. No, this is very interesting what you're saying, because what it exposes is that NATO was set up and continues to be an instrument of U.S. imperialism, not even of German national interests or French national interests or the other countries' national interests. And how do we know that's not the case, that they don't see it, that is the case, that they don't see it in their national interest? They don't pay anything into it.
That's right.
You know, it doesn't cost them anything to act like they have this joint agreement about Russian aggression and all this type of thing. No.
Right.
This is nothing but a very apparent instrument of U.S. foreign policy, and not just in Europe, because NATO is the spearhead, so-called NATO is the spearhead of the war in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
You know, it was the spearhead of the war to bring down the Gaddafi government in Libya.
Yeah.
And, you know, it will be the spearhead of a Hillary Clinton no-fly zone war against Syria.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's, I mean, it exposes the real nature of U.S. policy vis-a-vis NATO, I think what Trump is saying.
Yeah, I mean, if you while you're pondering these questions, it's interesting to note that, for example, this alliance among equals doesn't have a single German base or French base in the United States, okay? Allowing this common defense against Russia allows the U.S. occupation of much of Europe that's continued since World War II to continue to this day, and, you know, it's explained somehow within this framework.
But, you know, and you know, just to shift it a little bit, what we're saying, it took an anti-politician, a non-politician, a person who was not politically socialized and politically invested in the type of discourse and ideology that justifies American hegemony and American empire.
You saw an interesting phenomenon last night on exactly that point, because Ted Cruz and these other people, you know, sort of caught their taxi to the dustbin of history out of there. They insisted on hitting their ideological points on the way out.
Yeah.
Because it's almost compulsive, because whatever it is that lifted them there, you know, from behind the scenes, whatever sectors of the elite mm-hmm. that were invested somehow in those particular fractures among the rest mm-hmm. of us, mm-hmm. You know, they still are motivating these people, and they're still motivated by that. And so when you see instead a different framework actually taking traction mm-hmm. out among the people, then the possible consequences of that have got to be scaring the hell out of the mm-hmm. parts of the elite whose power rested on the, you know, these earlier constructs.
Yeah, and just to add to that, you take Newt Gingrich.
Yeah.
Now,
perfect example of what I was talking about.
Yeah. A guy that thinks he's the smartest guy in the room, the smartest guy in the world, and he's going to bring it all together, and he can control Trump and all. If you remember, if you listen to his speech, it was about American foreign policy.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
And he was justifying, literally, the Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama
foreign policy. Which was the George Bush foreign policy.
Which was the George Bush.
Which was the Bill Clinton foreign
Absolutely.
Policy. Which was the George Bush foreign policy.
That's right. That's right.
Yep.
And that's what he was doing.
Yep.
Now, he was trying to fit this
into
on
that.
Trump.
Right. Yeah.
But
didn't fit.
It didn't fit because the next day
we got the whole
in the New York Times.
Renunciation of that whole concept.
A whole renunciation of it.
Yep.
So here you have two irreconcilables.
Yeah.
The old Republican Party and its intellectual elites, and the Trump Party and the people, you know, trying to find a point of unity to defeat Hillary Clinton.
Right.
And I think, you know, I think Ted Cruz was only the beginning. I think going forward, we're going to see this thing unravel more. And I think, you know, because Newt Gingrich is kind of a emotionally immature and out of control, he's not going to be able to stay with Trump. And he's going to break with, because Trump is saying the opposite of everything he believes in. Now, the other thing is, Trump is more of a Keynesian.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
You know, let
that
us,
we've seen in a long time.
That's really. Right. He's more of a Keynesian than Obama, Hillary Clinton.
You know what?
He's and more of a New Deal Democrat than all of the Democrats since Bill Clinton.
This is what I think is lost on a lot of people. You know, I had heard, for example, one analyst who I have a great deal of respect for missed this point.
Yeah.
Trump, as a business person, has experience on the other end of Keynesian investment by mm-hmm. the government.
Mm-hmm. It,
when they do a project, they milk the hell out of every mm-hmm. available mm-hmm. local, state, and federal mm-hmm. subsidy, work the system to make sure that they're in place in the first place, make the decisions to base a project in a certain place on the mm-hmm. availability of that, which is, in essence, Keynesian. They give him the tax break. He hires the people to build the golf mm-hmm. course and maintain it mm-hmm. or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's lousy arithmetic mm-hmm. or accounting from mm-hmm. the point of view of hiring that way. Mm-hmm. It should be much more direct. But it is, in fact, Keynesian economics. And that's his bailiwick, really.
Yeah. And you know, we should not lose sight of the fact that, we could say Trump is a part of the 1%. But he's not a part of the financial oligarchy.
Yeah, that's which is a separate issue, too.
Yeah, this
the
is,
division between finance capital and industrial and
absolutely,
other capital. Major.
Absolutely. It's major. And he is saying, bring industry back.
Yep.
The financial oligarchy is saying, send industry to the cheapest parts of the
that's
world
right.
that you can find. And that's why, you know, when we drive in to Cleveland, and we pass these steel plants, these ghost plants.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
These people, that's what's driving their vote. And let's pick
Absolutely.
This up when we get to Philly next week.
Yes, yes, yes.
Tony, thanks
always,
a lot, man.
Always.
My pleasure. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.